Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast, the Scout Series, where we cover all things on the seed stage ecosystem. I'm your host, Gabrielle Marquez. Stick around to the end to find out how you can be our next guest. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast, the Scout Series. I'm your host, Gabby, and joining with me is Adam Chen, CRO of Finstrat Management. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Gabby. It's wonderful to be here.
I'm so excited to have you as one of my first guests as well.
I feel honored.
Well, let's kick it off and get into your background. I'd love to hear more.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, you know, I'm Chief Revenue Officer here at Finstrat Management. And I truly feel that it is, you know, the perfect role that kind of encapsulates my career. So without, you know, taking everyone through every high and low, you know, I started my career in sales and marketing and technology, kind of in the advent of web commerce, and cut my teeth doing a lot of Flash action script games. So I have a very technical background in that sense. You know, fast forward, working in entertainment industry, I then flipped over and worked running a communications contract at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. And, you know, got my hand at, you know, government contracting and kind of the fun parts about, you know, public relations and STEM education while also dealing with government bureaucracy. I also did short stints in ad agencies. I've always been kind of client side though. So that was my short stint being more on the agency side. Mm-hmm. And then went back to client side after my agency work, working for a large asset manager in the financial realm. And that's where I kind of fell in love with finance. Went back, got my MBA, realizing that that was a hurdle for me to, you know, continue to, you know, reach my aspirations. That afforded me the opportunities to really level up in my career. I did a short stint as a CIO, a chief information officer, doing a large on-prem to cloud migration project, leveraging some of that technical background I had. But then once that was in place, I kind of flipped sides of the table and took on my more natural role as a chief marketing officer at the same company. Through that opportunity, I was marketing a new technology product that we were bringing to market. And then I was afforded the opportunity to be president of a property technology kind of joint venture startup, which was mm-hmm. my, you know, real experience working in kind of these early stage environments. You know, and after a short stint in consulting, wanted to find my way back to finance. And here at Finstrat, it's kind of come full circle. I get to, you know, leverage my interest in finance as well as startups, and can kind of combine my marketing and technology prowess to help early stage founders today.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing. And just getting to know you over this past year, you'll soon find that Adam has worked in every single industry. He's worked just about so much. He knows everything is basically what I'm getting at. I feel like the more I learn from you, I'm like, you did this too? It's great. Which I also feel like helps you out a lot working with early stage founders.
It really
having
does.
An extensive background in multiple industries.
Yeah, I think it's become a superpower, maybe looking in the rearview mirror. I'd like to say that I cultivated that breath, you know, intentionally throughout my career. I think that sounds really good. I think the reality is I just had a little bit of career ADHD. But, you know, I worked on the corporate side and in enterprise for the majority of my career. I was kind of the entrepreneur, if you will, instead of an entrepreneur, but innovating from within organizations. That's given me a lot of understanding of how procurement happens, I think, in these enterprises. So that's some of the advice I can give to founders today is like, if you really want to sell to enterprise, you know, I have some experience being the buyer. I understand how the processes work. It's, I think, how I might define innovation as I think about it today, that kind of covers everything I've been through, is most of the time innovation doesn't come out of a vacuum. You know, it's mm-hmm. about borrowing ideas or paradigms or things that work really well in one area and then applying it in a new area. So I think that's what enables me to be successful in my role today, is I can just draw on some of this experience and draw kind of dots and make connection points where maybe
completely
where it didn't exist before.
I mean, I could not agree more. I think one of the big learning curves that I've experienced is kind of before you're heading into your career. In my head, everything is so separate. You've got product, you have biz dev, you have sales and marketing, but in finance. And as I'm kind of watching all these companies unfold and working within FinStrat, you realize everything is connected. So when you're talking about finance and you're talking about market, it's just this whole interconnected kind of game plan. It's not just one or the other. Everything is connected.
Great insight. It is all connected. You know, early in my career as a marketer, it's funny. I always kind of butted heads with the finance department, CFOs. You know, I had to pitch to a CFO very often early in my career. And I was always seen as a cost center. You know, in marketing, I think traditionally it's you know, you spend the money, right? So this evolution of my current role as chief revenue officer, I've been kind of working towards that my whole career, even before this, you know, before FinStrat, you know, because I always wanted to understand, like, you know, how do you draw that marketing activity and tie it all the way back to revenue? So to your point, you know, you can't be in sales, marketing, customer service, even technology. These are all enablement support to the one number that matters. It's driving revenue for the company, because how you can continue to expand, support your employees, you know, and grow the business.
Completely. And so, working with early stage founders now, how has your perspective shifted maybe from 10 years ago versus now? I mean, what it takes to be an early stage founder and growing in this ecosystem?
Great question. You know, I'm going to answer that in two different ways. I think drawing on my experience, there's one element that I understand and appreciate more about founders. And founders have to wear multiple hats. They don't have to be experts or really deep in any one particular area, but they have to be willing, able, and motivated, to play multiple roles. Like, whatever is the need of the day is kind of the founder's job. And, you know, we
Job
look,
titles don't mean anything.
no,
You
they do
taught me
not.
that.
They do not at the early stage. It's about the value that you can provide. It's about, you know, the knowledge to see the problem that is preventing you from getting to the next step, and being able to focus laser, you know, laser focus on that one problem and get through it. You know, I think as a founder, understanding that you can't do it alone, and understanding you need a support network, even if that's just for advice, even if that's just to vent, you need people that help you execute. You also need people to help, I guess, with your mental stability, because being a founder is hard. There's undue demands. You're trying to solve and do things maybe for the first time, right? In the breadth of work that you have to solve as a founder. So I think that's the backdrop I come into this with. But add on top of that, where we currently are in the market with AI being adopted, right? With you know, VC investment pouring into the space, you know, I would say the potential and possibilities of AI is progressing at a much faster rate than humans' ability to adopt and integrate those tools into production workflows. So I think today with AI, not only do you need to understand and stay up to date on the developments of what's possible, but I think change management and process is even more important now than ever, because you really need, as a founder, to lay out the expectations, the path for your co-founder, your first employees, you know, your future employees to adopt and use these tools in an effective and efficient way. Right. We see that in the market today with token maxing has taken over, right? I think I'm a big believer in incentives, right? And aligning incentive outcomes. And the truth of the matter is, if you just give people a play, you know, a sandbox to play in, without constraints, without, you know, knowing what success looks like, you know, they're going to just, you know, like many a company, blow their entire year's AI budget in the first, you know, half of the year. And that's what we're seeing here.
Completely. And I think a lot of people talk about entrepreneurship as this kind of, it's very chased after. I would say a lot of people are turning to in getting this idea of, well, maybe I can be my own boss. And so, what is something you think that people don't understand about entrepreneurship? I mean, you're saying AI is ramping up, the playing field is just getting higher and higher. What do you feel people should know before they decide to make that decision? Because you've really got to play hard. I mean, we talk about that all the time. It's the founder life isn't easy. And you're up against some people that really want it bad, that are pulling 80, 100-hour work weeks. I mean, what would you tell a founder that's deciding to make that jump?
I think being an entrepreneur can be one of the most rewarding experiences in someone's career.
Yeah,
You have
completely.
power, control to change outcomes, to build something from scratch, and that's really fulfilling. But
Definitely.
I would say, maybe it's a little recency bias with the, constant news cycle that we're in today, but you normally only hear about the success stories. You hear about the SpaceXs that just, finally went IPO with a $2.2 trillion valuation, right? And you hear about that. But what you don't hear about is the other 100 startups, right, that failed to get to where SpaceX is, right?
Yeah.
The chances of success, early stage to become one of these big unicorn companies is really small, really hard. So you just have to be realistic too. And it's not just, we love to tell kids, right? You can be anything when you grow up, right? I think that's actually false. It's not true. I think you want to appeal to people's aspirations and goals and give them the potential, but you can't brute force some of this stuff. You need to hit the right timing. You need to have the right support network. You need to know the right people, because part of success in this game isn't just about hustle, which you absolutely need. I don't want to
Yeah.
discount that, but it's also just, are you in the right space at the right time? Right.
Yeah.
And I think
And
it's the
sometimes it's not
awesome.
about the idea.
Sometimes it's not. There's inferior products that have been incredibly successful, right? And I think, we deal with a lot of technical founders, and I think that's kind of the other side of this is, a good idea and a good product does not make a business, right? A business requires, sales and marketing. It requires finance. It requires all these other disciplines that maybe, you didn't initially think about as an entrepreneur. I just want to build something that's going to change the world. But then how do you make that a self-sustaining ecosystem, right? And an actual functional business that can grow and appeal to the benefits and goals of multiple stakeholders, right? For some of these big unicorn companies, you have founder goals that sometimes don't exactly overlap with investor goals, but you need capital in order to scale, right? And you have all these other stakeholders in the boardroom that are going to provide governance, that come at it from different lenses. So, that's really it. You can't just build. You have to do all of the other things that it takes to operate a business.
Completely. I mean, there's so many things that go into it. And especially with AI now, I mean, you can optimize so many of those workflows currently. And follow-up question, kind of in this whole AI native landscape, now that this is becoming commoditized, what would you say the moat is for these founders' businesses? Would you say it's the network or the work ethic? What is your opinion?
I think there's a couple different ways you could look at that question. The first moat that I think is pretty easy to say is data with AI, right? Access to build the tools on top of some of this stuff is accessible to all. It's democratized, I guess, in that way. But if you have a proprietary data set that can pull unique insights from, that is one moat. We're thinking about applications, but there's a lot of other, elements of AI. If you look up and down the kind of the vertical sum, right, there's infrastructure, for example, right? And NVIDIA just has, the moat because they have the best processors and best chips, right? So I think, we run into it a lot at the application layer where people build wrappers, so to speak, on top of these LLMs. Like, that's the antithesis of building a moat, right? You need some underlying IP and tech, your own model, your own data set, something else that is powering the insights you deliver or the productivity you deliver, whatever it is you're building, that's defensible, that somebody else can't replicate. So sometimes at the early stage, that could be, deep expertise in a particular domain, and you have access to the preeminent, thought leaders or researchers in that particular space. That could be a moat. But you have to answer the question if you're going to go raise. So you got to come up with a good answer. But the answer could be many things.
Yeah, completely. And speaking of raising, I mean, a lot of founders who are just tinkering. I mean, you always like to say some of the best founders, the people who are just building on their free time. For people who don't have that financial background, what would you say is a common misconception when these founders go out to raise?
I run into it. I think again, this is just because of the news cycle. We hear all this news, and we always you go on X, for example, and you see all this funding announcements. Oh, the X company just closed $6 million seed round. Y company just closed a $9 million A round. I see them every day, right, on our
Oh,
LinkedIn
yeah.
feed too. So again, I think it's just like how many founders successfully reach the A round. And the reality is that, even A rounds are harder to come by here in 2026. So I think the misconception is that money is easy to come by. It's not, right? VCs, investors will pass on deals for, nothing more than a gut reaction to something. I think the cold hard truth at the early stage, especially seed, is you only have so much financials. So often these times these investors are investing on confidence, on their gut. Did you present well? Do you have the background to win in the space? Why are you differentiated from others that might try to enter the space? Like, why are you going to be the horse that wins in the race? That's the question. And oftentimes that's intangibles. So you can have the best product in the world, but if they don't buy your confidence in presenting the opportunity, you might not even get the opportunity to explain to them how it works. And so I think it's a matter of like, this goes back to technical founder. In order to be successful in raising money, you also need to be a salesperson and you need to understand the dynamics. And so it's all of the other stuff than just building the product that's ultimately going to get you that first check cut.
Completely. Yeah, I mean, raising capital now, it seems. I mean, I only entered this industry not too long ago, but from what I've heard, it's a hard time to do it. I would say, yeah, it's the product, but then it's also telling the story, and also that ties in finances, like where do you see yourself in 5 years? And then there's the investors that really just want to know a founder, and it's less about the product than it is just how well can we work together? Are you somebody that really believes in your idea? And so I think it's so interesting just from an investor lens of what are you looking for? And speaking of raising, I would say I'm curious to see, and I'm also curious in your opinion, with the IPO from SpaceX. I mean, capital has kind of been tied up in a lot of companies not going public recently. And hopefully this might trigger a wave of other companies potentially wanting to go public.
It's interesting. I know there's so many thought leaders out there that look at the macro environment. So, take what I say with a grain of salt from just one man's lens. But I think there's two sides to fundraising, right? There's the LPs that fund the VC funds that then in turn invest in founders. But one is intrinsically linked to the other. So there's a lot of VCs. There was a big valuation reset, 2022, 2023. That meant on paper, a lot of the investments that were made were kind of break even or maybe at a loss with the valuations. So now, and again, VC is illiquid capital, right? So it's all tied up, it doesn't get returned to the LPs until an event happens in the underlying company, right? In so many ways. So SpaceX, huge signal, biggest IPO ever. Obviously, later this year, we're following with some other big names and OpenAI and Anthropic. These have stayed in the private markets longer than ever before. Any private company has stayed private ever before. So even more money is locked up, right? So, yes, I think the short answer is these IPOs will unlock a lot of liquidity. It'll be returned after lockup periods back to LPs. The LPs will then feel more comfortable reinvesting in future VC funds, which in turn should then unlock capital and allow more deployment to the founders. And I think the other dynamic you see is that, look, the big players in the industry, the Sequoias, the Andreessens of the world, right? They have no problem raising capital today. But there's a huge segment of the VC market that, especially those that cater to the very early stages, right? That it hasn't been tough going. So I do think this will unlock, but it's not an unlock today. It's still going to take some time for it to play out.
It is a long process. And obviously FinStrat's raising a fund right now, which all has our investor lenses on. So my question to you, Adam, you're given 50 million tomorrow. What are you bullish on?
Ooh, what am I bullish on? You know, another why reason I think it's a good fit with FinStrat a little bit, but there where our fund is focused is also where I think there's immense opportunity. So everyone knows about the SaaS apocalypse, but you know,
No, I'd actually never heard it
you never
referred
heard
to
of
as
that?
that, but I
Right.
like
I mean,
that.
like, look, SaaS companies were because of the recurring business model and the recurring revenue model is very easy to, you know, forecast and predict. You know, that was with the Salesforces coming onto the scene, you know, 10, 15 years ago or whatnot, like that was the business model. And everyone invested in SaaS companies and software companies. And I think with AI, we're seeing it now. You know, a lot of those SaaS companies have lost a lot of value via their stock price. Now I think it's overblown, right? A lot of companies, especially enterprise, have a lot of integrations. They build a lot of operational processes around some of these systems. This isn't a flip the switch and these companies disappear overnight. These companies are also well capitalized and will also innovate. To think that the incumbents are not innovating in the space of AI is, I think, a fool's game. So, what I think is though, but organizations are much slower, right? The larger you get, the slower you move, right? In so many ways. So I think that's the opportunity in early stage startup software, especially is, you know, can you gain enough market share because you can move fast, right? In this moment in time, and you've now democratized access to development and become hyper efficient, doing all the things, right? All the benefits of AI. And can you displace some incumbents before the incumbents are able to catch up? I think that's the question that we have. So, where I would invest my money is in founders that index for speed, that understand the market dynamics and the opportunity presented to themselves and hustle more than they've ever hustled before, and also have, you know, the market dynamics in their favor to capture some market share to reach critical mass before the competition catch ups. That's what I'm looking for, is that weird intersection in is like moment in time. That's pretty broad, but like some sectors I think that I'm super bullish on,
I mean,
specifically.
like you said, it's multiple avenues that you got to be looking at.
It is, you know, it's again, but I think it's the adoption thing I mentioned earlier. So, you know, whether it's cybersecurity, whether it's, you know, space tech with you know, the SpaceX IPO, you know, whether it's, you know, I live a lot in CRM, like what's going to potentially displace CRM? This is the perfect example of what I'm articulating, right? It's like the capabilities of SaaS software and CRMs grew much faster than any company that was able to adopt and implement those tools. So look across the landscape 10, 15 years on from mass adoption of CRMs, and what do you see? You see middling implementation, sometimes it's successful, it's still missing data, right? It's the problem is people. The problem is that it's you got a standardized process and get everyone to use the tool in a very similar way, right, to gain insights. That's what AI is decoupling. Now you're not necessarily as reliant on people to get to the data. You don't necessarily need to structure it. You can kind of deal with some unstructured data. Now there's so much more you can unpack there, but that's the power of AI, is being able to potentially displace some of these legacy softwares and do it in new and novel ways that remove the burden on humans' ability to change.
Wow, that was really good. I think that those are the insights you need. I mean, if you're going to be making investment decisions to founders, you need to be understanding human behavior more than anything. And I think it's an interesting thing to predict. I mean, Adam, we obviously get into just psychology and human behavior topics constantly. But that's really interesting. I really like that. I will say, I thought you were going to say something space tech related. I thought you were going to say fun to some sort of quantum or space to something really exciting, because I think that's what I'm kind of bullish on, but not in the sense of, oh, this is where I think things are going to take off. And I mean, obviously,
Sure.
things will in both those areas, but in my head, I'm like, I just want to see things come to life, people with the most unique ideas. I
Yeah.
think people are out here. We were just at the Colorado Deep Tech Summit a month ago, and we were just talking to founders. And you speak with these people that, you can tell a founder is dedicated to their craft when they you can hear it in their voice. They sound so passionate about what it is that they're building. And speaking a lot with these space tech founders, I mean, some of the things they're coming up with, I mean, sending data centers into space. I think it's so interesting to see where things could go and to be a part of that process and a part of history, I think would be an exciting avenue to take investing down.
Yeah, I
And
mean, clearly I love space, right? And having worked in NASA, but the way I think about it is, I think there's immense opportunity in space. It's the new, exploration, just like people were exploring the seas, hundreds of years ago. We're now figuring out space. But I think about it differently because I have that background in asset management. I guess it's been ingrained in me in this idea of total portfolio management and asset allocation. So I, even in my own personal investing, right, I don't look at one particular sector. I really try to look at, like, how's this plug into the whole? And am I getting exposure in an area where I'm keen on? But I'm not putting all my eggs in one basket, right? Because I still need to look at the return profile across all my investments, private, public, right? So I think I apply that in the same way I think about, early stage investing too, in some sense, where because I have this breadth of experience, I can see opportunities in a bunch of different areas, and that gets me a little bit excited. And I don't want to pigeonhole myself into, like, just space tech, right?
Completely.
And just bet in one industry.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the power law a lot too. I mean, one portfolio company is going to bring all your return, and spreading it out across multiple, I mean, that's the way to go. And as we're coming up on time, I have a few questions for you.
Sure.
For those of you who don't know, Adam has been one of my mentors this first year here working at FinChat. Adam, I would love to spread the knowledge. What is one book, podcast, TED Talk you would recommend to anybody in the seed stage ecosystem, whether as an investor, founder, operator?
Yeah, there's so many I could reference. I'm a huge fan of Adam Grant. He's had a huge impact on me. I've read all of his books just from a general, behavioral psychology lens. But I think very specifically, and I actually give a talk on this, is something around, it's called The Behavior Statement. And there's a gentleman by the name of Matt Wallert, who wrote a book, Start with the End. And I had the fortunate opportunity of both reading the book in college and actually having Matt come to my class to present to us this idea of a behavioral statement. And it's very closely related to an ICP, an ideal customer profile, in sales and marketing speak. But it's geared a little bit more towards a behavior change to orient internal teams towards a particular goal. So, said another way, ICP is very externally facing. It's like, who am I targeting, right? What's the benefits for them to buy the thing that I want to buy? A behavioral statement is taking that one step further and saying, internal teams, this is the ICP, and here's the behavior change we want to evoke in the buyer. Right. So is that they need them to do something differently, log in here instead of there, right? Have the conversation to this person instead of that person. Like, at the end of the day, business is nothing more than behavior change, right? Like, you come up with a new novel idea in isolation, it's doing nothing. In effect, what you're trying to do is get people to behave differently. Maybe that's to develop something differently with AI now instead of hand coding something, right? The behavior you're trying to do is, like, become an editor of somebody else's code. So you're turning a whole bunch of developers into, a developer's manager in so many ways, right? Like, that is a behavior change. So The way I present this is kind of around, and I encourage everyone to go check out Matt Wallert's stuff. He's got free lessons online on his website to try to share this message, but I fully adopted it in my own practice to develop these behavior statements. I help guide some of our founders through these behavior statements, and I explain it simply about, you get drift over time, right? If you don't keep internal development teams aligned, especially as we're hyper productive, right, you might develop all these functions and features that might take you away from the core behavior you're trying to change in the buyer. And it's all about focus at this early stage. So developing the shared language and shared goals is super, super important.
Okay. So wait, say one more time. It's Matt. I don't
It's
want to
Matt
butcher it.
Wallert. His name is spelled Wallert. But behavioral scientist who also is a practitioner.
Okay. Got it. Well, thank you. And
And the
that
book is Start at the End is the name of the book.
start at the end. Got it. Great. Well, that kind of leads me into my last question, in regards to behavior. When you're interviewing anybody, as a potential just to work on a team with us, besides knowledge, what is one trait that you look for in a person?
Ooh, good question. It's intangible, and my interview style is probably very unique, but what I'm looking for more than anything else is the willingness to try, the willingness to act.
That's so good. Yeah.
That's it. It's as simple as that. It's like there's this very common concept called like the knowledge action gap, and I think there's so many thought leaders out there that talk about it, but what prevents us from deriving outcomes isn't because we don't know what to do. We all know, like deep down, really, it is what we want to do. The problem is, how do you act? How do you act on what you know? So the people that have a proclivity to act, that just try, that aren't afraid of failing, the old SF trope of fail fast, try again. I mean, it's how do you embody that? If I can see that in somebody
Yeah.
that you
I mean,
can't
you're
see.
running on pure adrenaline. I think that is such a good answer. I mean, there's plenty of smart people out there. I think the best teams of people are the ones who just want it one as bad as you or willing to do just about anything, and they simply care. You can really tell when someone's heart's in their work.
100%, 100%. I'm envious oftentimes sitting across the table or side by side at the table with founders. Going back to the beginning, my career has been about breadth. I can sit here today with all confidence in the world and say, I don't have the laser focus that it takes to be a successful founder in today's age. So I'm envious when I sit next to somebody at the table who has that laser focus and passion and drive. And it energizes me too, and I want to help that person. That's it. It's a complementary relationship that I look for.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely tell. I mean, I would say similar, maybe not exactly envious is the right word, but you do kind of feel a little bit sense of, wow, I would love to know what it's like to be in your shoes right now, to feel so passionate about something and build from scratch.
Absolutely.
Well, great answer. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, Adam. It's been a pleasure.
This is super fun. Love talking to you, and I know we'll have a number of good conversations in the future as well.
I'm excited about it. All righty. Well, thank you guys for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast, the Scout Series. I'm your host, Gabby, and I will see you guys next time. Bye. If you want more deep dives into early stage growth and venture strategy and potentially be a next guest, head over to our main hub at finstratmgmt.com/podcast. You can catch up on past episodes and find tools to help you level up your career and your company.